What's up, family? You are tuned into Law & Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. This is Resistance in Residence, where we profile artists using their gifts to change the world. This week's Resistance in Residence artist is rhythm guitarist, orchestrator, composer, and producer Ella Rae Feingold, who's toured and recorded with the who's who of modern black music, like Queen Latifah, Erykah Badu, The Roots, Jay-Z, Corinne Bailey-Ray, Eric Benet, Silk Sonic, which is Anderson .Paak and Bruno Mars, and many more. Ella, thank you for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
I'm so grateful to have you on because I've been seeing you online for a number of years now. And before that, I saw you in the flesh on stage for quite a few years. And
Cool. I didn't know that.
I'm going to be asking you mostly questions, but I wanted to start out by just like framing it by telling a quick story.
Yeah.
Which is that the first time I saw you on stage, I saw you play guitar with Queen Latifah in 2005 at the Concord Pavilion. At the Sugar Water Festival, which was this incredible festival featuring Queen Latifah, but also Floetry, Jill Scott, and Erykah Badu. And at the time, I was still in high school, and I was obsessed with Erykah specifically, but also appreciated all those other artists. My friends were not really into the same music as I was, so I convinced my mom to take me to the show. and I've seen a whole lot of shows since then. And as a young musician in particular, that one was pivotal. And I think on that show a lot. So I want to thank you for being a part of that memory for me.
Wow. I mean, that takes me back. I happen to remember that show just because I have family that's from the Bay Area. And I remember they came to check out the show. Yeah, that was my first major tour. So I have a lot of memories from those years.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so I'm going to ask you about your touring experience a little bit more later, because I know you did that. And then I've also seen you play with Erykah many times. But taking a little step back, and also to bring our listeners up to speed, because I know many of them don't know who you are, I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself and talk a little bit earlier in your life, what led you to pick up the guitar and like to take it really seriously as a young person?
Okay. Well, hi, I'm Ella Feingold. Let's see. I guess I got into guitar around maybe 12 years old, I think. And I think at that point in my life, I felt like I needed a mask to kind of get through life. And music seemed like a good mask to wear. And I really feel like seeing that movie La Bamba, you know, the story of Ritchie Valens, just awoken, you know, something in me. It's not that I necessarily wanted to be like a rock and roll star or something, but I don't know, just something about music and specifically the guitar. But if I was to say music in general, absolutely Michael Jackson, because I know that when I was in preschool, I used to just dance on the tables at school. So I'd have to say it starts with Michael, but guitar is La Bamba when I was like 12, maybe.
Okay. Already I have all the follow-up questions, but one of the things you said is that it's not like I wanted to be a rock and roll star or something. As a young guitarist, was there never a point where you were like, I want to be a rock and roll star?
I think that I don't really have any memories of that. I think I always wanted to be successful and to be able to work with musicians that I really admired. But I don't really have any memories of just, you know, like being center stage, like shredding guitar and melting people's faces. Not really, which is maybe why, you know, I'm a rhythm guitar player.
As a young person who started out playing guitar, I'm a bass player now, but as when I was young, I started out playing guitar. I certainly had these like dreams of, or I would watch these old Hendrix tapes and I'd be like, oh, I want to be like that. I no longer want to be like that. But as a young person, that was super exciting for me. But you mentioned it already. Let's talk a little bit about rhythm guitar and what that means. as someone who's also taught music to kids, one thing I've heard from young people, the difference between rhythm guitar and lead guitar is like the rhythm guitar is more boring or something like that. I know that's absolutely not the case for you. So I wonder, what brought you to rhythm guitar and what does that role really mean for you?
I mean, I guess more than anything, what brought me there is the feeling, you know, and it's a really good feeling. It's unfortunate that we do have to compartmentalize these different aspects of music, like lead guitar and rhythm guitar and all, you know, like it should just be music. Like we're all musicians and rhythm and making something feel good should be a given, whether you're, you know, Nick Drake or Taylor Swift or James Brown, like, and feel good doesn't have to mean funky, but just feel good, you know? And I guess maybe that phrase is subjective, depending on who you ask, but I guess just the feeling and knowing that it was sort of this kind of intangible thing that either feels good or it doesn't, just kind of like when certain people hear the blues, they just know in two notes whether that person is being honest on their instrument or not. So I think, you know, part of it was just that you couldn't see it, you know, like you could only feel it. And I would say as I matured more as a musician, I really, although I always valued it, I really came to appreciate that that's quite literally what keeps you working and what sets you apart from other musicians, you know? And, I'm probably sort of, you know, butchering a quote from Prince, but he said something to the effect of like, nobody wants to hear you solo if your rhythm sucks. You know, and he kind of talked about it in an interview that like, you know, that we get it wrong, that all these guitar players start on soloing and that rhythm is just something that just happens later along. And it's like, no, it starts with making something feel good. Because when you can make something feel good, whatever notes you decide to choose, it doesn't matter. I mean, it does, but it's run through the filter of it feeling good.
Well, I'm going to jump into a portion of the conversation that I was planning to get to later, but because you're talking about it, I know you're also an orchestrator, and I've seen you on online talk about coming up with rhythm guitar parts itself as part of orchestration, and I'm wondering if you can draw that out for listeners, also, of course, for some folks who are less musically focused, but you know, I've heard you talk about within one rhythm guitar part, some portion is the kick drum, some portion is the snare, some portion is the horn section, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I think because I'm an orchestrator, I can't help think that way with like an orchestrator or arranger's brain rather than just a guitar player's brain. As far as the drums go, I mean, I truly look at the guitar as a pitched percussion instrument. I know to a lot of other people, the guitar is this legato, singing, you know, melodic, soaring instrument. And to be honest, a lot of these instruments were created to sing, you know, and to replicate the human voice, even if it was an oboe or a guitar that it's meant to sustain. I just look at it as a drum. And I sort of split up all the different strings into different drums, and I bang the guitar like a drum. You know, and it starts there with hitting it like a drum and then just happen to be dropping in notes and chords, which, you know, give it melodic content. But that's how I feel the instrument, you know, first before anything.
Well, I think that also is helpful for us to think about how you think of rhythm guitar, because if you think of it as drums are what many people have as the like go-to for what's driving the rhythm from a song. Of course, all the instruments are involved in the rhythm of a song. You also talked a little bit earlier about the importance of creating a feeling, and that's a big part of the role of rhythm guitar. You also mentioned some artists that are in very different genres, James Brown, Taylor Swift, etc. The feeling is different for different kinds of music. You particularly play Black American music, and Black American music that also has built out from a legacy of funk, soul, R&B, and gospel. And please correct me if there's other things that I'm leaving out there. But no. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what that's meant for you and also what that's meant for you as a white person.
That's a good question. Well, I say Black American music because, I mean, that's literally what it is, and give credit where credit's due. And I think that a lot of folks don't know that, and they just think that Elvis is Elvis because of Elvis and not because of people that, you know, came before him. But at the end of the day, it is just music to me. It either, you know, feels good and reaches you or it doesn't. But I think what happens to connect with me more than anything is, you know, is Black American music. I'm kind of always just like the only white chick in the band. So I never think of it anymore. You know what I mean? It's just what I do, you know, it's how I live my life and the music I hear and want to create. So it's not something I'm really conscious of at this point. You know, I'd say in the beginning of my career, it was more just like, you know, I guess what I want to say is no one made me feel this way, but I sort of felt like a guest to the music a little bit in the very early years, you know, of just like, am I funky enough? Am I carrying my weight? Am I overplaying, you know? And now it just feels like, I don't know, like an old worn pair of jeans. Like they just feel comfortable and it's just a great feeling. You know, if I'm not being like overly weird or poetic, but yeah, that's what the music is now. It just feels like just comfortable, like an old friend that I know, you know?
Well, let's talk a little bit more. Let's go back a little and talk a little bit more about how you got to that comfort level. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your relationship with Spanky, learning some things from Spanky, and introduce Spanky to listeners who don't know who that is. And then how you ended up in some of these very Black touring bands where you were the white chick in the band, as you just described.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, the comfort came from a lot of discomfort. And I don't mean having anything to do with who I was keeping company with, but discomfort in being in musical scenarios where, you know, I was sort of the weakest one, you know, and over years of discomfort of having to hear quickly and find my place in the music very quickly, that it soon turned into comfort. But you know, yeah, it started with my first mentor, Spanky, Chalmers, Eddie Spanky Alford. You know, for those that are, you know, listening from the Bay Area, he worked with Tony, especially on the House of Music record, like that song, Thinking of You, that's Spanky all day. And then, you know, he was a member of the Mighty Clouds of Joy and worked with the Gospel Keynotes and the Canton Spirituals and the whole quartet scene. And then, you know, working with Raphael led to working with, like, you know, D'Angelo and the Soulquarians and Dilla and just that, you know, Angie Stone, that whole musical movement, you know, that bloomed around that time. And I basically, you know, cold called him. This was, you know, way before sort of social media, and I was able to track him down and we played for each other over the phone. I think he was really touched and blown away that I sort of did my homework on him and really just studied a lot of the records that he played on, like some really like in the cut records that nobody would know about. And I'd say after like 6 months or a year of talking, he just called me one day and he had gotten home from a session and said, come to Huntsville, Alabama, and we can play guitar for like a week. I was going to school at Berklee College of Music, and I dropped out to go study with him because I knew that would be the most important thing, you know, in my musical development. And it was, and I went down there and we played guitar for a week and every day for hours and hours. And I felt like, I know that when I got back to Boston, I was a completely different person and a musician and guitar player because of him. And It really opened up a lot of doors, not just because of the musical generosity and gifts that he shared with me, but just also the association, you know. It sort of led to working with Questlove and James Poyser and certain people just because it's like, oh, you know, you're Spanky's student. I mean, it was also because I was, you know, good at what I do, but that really opened a lot of doors because anyone that knew Spanky that's listening, you know, he was just a remarkable man and the most musically generous person I've ever met. I mean, who invites a stranger to come just shed with them for a week? He didn't want any money, you know. He knew how wildly important that would have been for me in my life at that time. And he was excited to just share that time with me. And he knew, I'll never forget or remember, he was just looking at me randomly when we were playing and he stopped and he just said, I know you're just freaking out right now. Like, you can't believe this is happening. And he was absolutely right.
Yeah. What an incredible and life-changing opportunity. I'm wondering just real briefly, if you could, in words, obviously it's harder in words than on your guitar, but if in words, if you could kind of describe what he brought to the instrument that made him in some ways like the gold standard of what a lot of guitar players, particularly in gospel and R&B, look to. I mean, of course, there were so many guitar players. He's absolutely not the only one, but yeah, he is kind of a major reference point.
I don't know if I could give, like, you know, words. I mean, he certainly was soulful and greasy, but I would say more than anything is he came from like a jazz background and fused jazz guitar harmony, like Wes Montgomery, Joe Pass, Johnny Smith, Barney Kessel, stuff like that, with triadic gospel quartet music, you know, and blues and gut bucket stuff like Cornell Dupree. And so I think it was just his musical gumbo and then just his patience and his touch and greasiness in the way that he played made him, you know, incredibly unique.
And from that experience, you had quite a journey on the stage. What was it like for you? Certainly, you know, we started the conversation talking about the tour that you were on playing in Queen Latifah's band. I don't know if you played more with Queen Latifah before beyond that specific tour.
Yeah, but I know.
Oh, you did. Great. I'd love for you to talk about that. But also, like, what was it like for you to get the call to join Erykah Badu's band, who you toured with for many, many years?
Yeah, I mean, that was a dream come true. I mean, you saw Erykah during that tour. I was just so moved. I mean, I've always been a fan of hers. And every night I just would watch their show from the monitors or go out front. And, you know, when I talk about like music just being a good feeling, like a comfortable pair of jeans, like her music is just, it feels so good to be inside of her music on stage. I've never, ever felt anything like that. And I've been in some really wonderful musical situations, but there's just kind of, it's like music that takes its time. And it's like music that's not in a hurry. And I just loved hearing her play every night and wished, like, God, I want to be in her band because it's just all feel and vibe and color, you know? And I just sort of felt maybe selfishly like I belong in that, you know, ball of music. Like, I know that I can add to that, you know, and augment it. I got the call. And it's funny because my first gig with her, a lot of people don't know this, but there was sort of a famous performance that she gave on VH1 Soul Stage. I think it was like 2008.
Yeah.
And Chris Dave was in the band. And they were in, I think, Nigeria performing. And so I had to take a red eye and meet them in Brooklyn to do that concert. I had never performed with them. I had never even rehearsed with them. And I didn't even have a set list. I just sort of checked out, you know, her catalog. So that was the first gig I had ever done in my entire life. And there's a song she did called Annie, like Annie Don't Wear No Panties. And it's this funk tune. And I, you know, I don't know, without sounding like self-congratulatory, I think it's some of my best guitar playing, just because I had never heard the song in my entire life. I didn't even know what key we were in. I had to put the guitar up to my ear to find the key. So that whole song and performance was just purely instinctual and listening and reacting and getting in where I fit in, you know, as opposed to learning something and overthinking it. It was just very instinctual, and I'm really proud, and people ask me about that performance all the time, and you know, I'm like, man, I was literally improvising the whole song.
That's amazing to hear, because you mentioned that performance, and I was going to ask you about that song specifically, because I remember watching it in right after it came out. And it was incredible. I want to reach back again to earlier in our conversation. I know we're a little bit all over the place, but one of the ways you described your earlier experience of picking up guitar and kind of diving into it, you said that you needed a mask to get through life, and guitar was that mask. Uh-huh. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what you meant by that.
I can. I mean, if it's appropriate to talk about for your listeners, but
absolutely,
it's my humanity, so it's who I am. I mean, so for those that don't know, I'm a transgender woman, and I knew who I was my whole life. I didn't get to live authentically until much later in life, and life was pretty unbearable back then, you know, because I wasn't able to live as who I actually am, you know, in my brain and in my soul and whatnot. So I just needed a way to get through life and sort of hide behind something. And music was a mask, and it quite literally kept me alive. You know, it was something I could seek refuge in and hold on to and comfort me. And it was also something I could just go down musical rabbit holes on, in order to not have to deal with my life and what I was actually going through, you know? Yeah.
And your gender identity and the absolute clarity with which you speak about it. I mean, you were young, when you knew this part of yourself, and, you know, there's all kind of legislation around the country attacking trans people.
Yeah.
And particularly focusing on young people. And I'm so glad that you were able to find some space of freedom within music as a kid, because you've brought so much music into this world that's been so great. But I'm also wondering if you ever think back on what it could have been like if there were room for you as a young person to really embrace your gender authentically.
You know, I actually try not to think about it, because it's just painful. I just sort of feel like there are so many lost years, you know, of not getting to be me and sort of watching life pass me by. I mean, I do also sort of take comfort in that, you know, there's no wrong time to transition. It's never too late to be you. You know, it's never too late to start over. So I don't have regret transitioning when I did, but yeah, it's hard to think about, you know, what things could have been like back then, you know, if I was able to be accepted. And I just, you know, I'm 43, and I knew, you know, in the mid 80s. So I just feel like I would have probably had a really brutal life of being homeschooled and ostracized and in therapy and on medicine and people trying to understand why I'm a certain way. And it sort of says a lot about trans people, because here I am in the 80s, raised by heterosexual parents. I don't even know what the word trans is. I don't know any trans people. Mm-hmm. And yet I knew who I was very early on. I didn't know what the word was for it, but I knew something's not right and I'm not a boy. You know, so the moral of the story is, you know, people know and believe people when they tell you, you know, who they are. And this whole notion of people are too young to know. I mean, I knew around 5, and I just knew to my core. And I'm 43 years old now. I transitioned at 40. And a lot of people, you know, connect with me and feel a sense of comfort around me because I am who I am. And it sort of maybe gives them permission to be them. And I guess what I'd like to say for people that don't believe that trans kids exist is that I was a trans kid. I was one of those kids that you don't think knew who they were back then. And I'm telling you, I knew who I was.
Yeah.
And I'm here today, you know, just a woman in the world, just trying to do her best in the world, you know, spread some love through music and just have some joy. So.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I hope I didn't bring too much when
no,
I was,
not at all. No, not at all. No, happy to talk about it. I think it's important to talk about, you know, just because of all the crazy legislation and just the people trying to get other people to hate girls like me. You know, I think it's important to normalize it and bring humanism to it. So you can actually get to actually talk to someone who's trans, because a lot of these people that pass legislation and hate people like me, they don't even know us. They've never taken the time to hear about our lives. And, you know, there was a quote from Mr. Rogers, and it was something like, there's nobody, you know, you couldn't love once you've heard their story. And it's not his quote, but it was something that he said, and he got it from someone else. And I've just always thought about that, not only for my own life, but just for life in general. And, you know, hey, this is part of my story. So I hope you could love me for it.
And I absolutely love your Mr. Rogers reference point. He was a big impact on many of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, yeah. He's so wonderful.
I also wanted to ask about your experience as a touring musician and, you know, making a decision to transition in other ways. Of course, you knew about your own gender identity, but I know that often in musical spaces where there's a lot of men around, that there's a lot of like hyper masculine conversations.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you'd be comfortable talking at all about what that experience was like for you, being aware of yourself not fitting into the same kind of body that some of those other musicians were in, that kind of musician culture.
Yeah. I mean, I think because I had music, I could hide behind a lot of things, like I said earlier. So, you know, this sort of, I don't know, fragile or toxic masculinity that I would experience, you know, just sort of the patriarchy in general, it bothered me. It made me feel uncomfortable, but I sort of just had music to hold on to. And I could also just sense that all of those things just came from a place of not knowing who they were, you know?
Yeah.
And I certainly see that magnified today by the people, you know, that don't like me, because it's very much not about me, because they don't even know me, you know? So you couldn't possibly hate me, because if you don't know me. So just with those types of those things, I mean, even back then, I just knew that's about you. That's not about me.
Mm-hmm. And you made a conscious decision, I believe, to get off the road.
I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can. Yeah. Well, you know, I was on the road for 10 years straight, living out of a suitcase. I mean, of course, I had like a house, you know, a home, an apartment, but for the most part, kind of never really being home for longer than like 4 days or something. I just got really burnt out from doing it, as grateful as I was to have all of those opportunities. I think it was one of those things of like, be careful what you wish for, you know, it just might happen or come true. I just wasn't prepared for the life of touring. I just thought I wanted it on paper. And it was a lot, you know, on your body. Not, you know, the music part's easy, the doing, learning the show and rehearsing. The hard part is just the traveling and being away and, you know, emotionally feeling lost at times and isolated, and the fact that your time is not really your time, you know?
Yeah.
And being transgender and having not transitioned at that point in my life, like there was a lot of gender dysphoria and just feeling just an overall sense of agitation and discomfort. And I think touring in and of itself can bring a lot of discomfort. And so it just became a lot, you know, for me. And I just didn't want to be on the road anymore. I wanted to be able to do music and do it from the house. And I got into the craft of orchestration, and that's how that, you know, eventually changed. And then I did get off of the road for, you know, a good 10 years. And now I'm actually just starting to get back in, like dip my toes back into spot dates and stuff like that. I'll be in I don't know if I'm even allowed to say it. So I'll just say I'll be in Napa in September, performing at that that Blue Note Jazz Festival. I don't know if I'm allowed to say who yet. So I'll keep that under wraps. So I'll be out your way.
That's great. I might be able to check you out there. Ella, our time is just about up. I'm wondering if you can share anything that you're working on right now, any projects that folks should be looking out for, and how can people follow you?
Yeah, so as far as projects go, another Bay Area legend, Charlie Hunter, and I, my yes. dear friend, are working on a record, slowly and surely. Just had a song come out with Bootsy Collins called Album of the Year, Number One Funketeer. Just had another song come out last week with Wolfmon, Jack Stratton of Wolfpack, and Evangeline, and that's got Nate Smith on drums and Joe Dart. It's like a hell of a rhythm section. So those are some things that came out. Was just in Guitar Player magazine last month. They wrote some really nice words on me. As far as where to check me out, I have an Instagram, which is Ella_Rae, R-A-E, and then _ Feingold, F-E-I-N-G-O-L-D. And I have a Patreon page where I just teach a lot. And that's, you can also find that, just Ella Feingold and Patreon.
Well, Ella Feingold, I want to thank you for joining us here on KPFA and giving us your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Really, thank you for thinking of me and including me in your program. I'm
very grateful. That's the voice of this week's Resistance in Residence artist, rhythm guitarist, orchestrator, composer, and producer, Ella Rae Feingold.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA, that's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. Our Resistance in Residence theme music was composed by Jesse Strauss. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA, that's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.